Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome, and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 64 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. So, announcements this week?
All three of them.
I don't know, it's like, I feel like we are in the middle of Droughtlander, but I still enjoy the ones that we get, but it's almost easier prepping for the announcement section when there's so little being kicked out by Stars this time of year. But that's okay. So, we're still happy for everything we get. We did get some photos from the Outlander Stars Instagram account. The first one was of Claire, sort of a behind-the-scenes shot with her kneeling in some fallen leaves. But if you just glance at it briefly, it looks like she's being swallowed by the leaves. Like she's sinking into them. But you can just see her foot in the background, which ruins it. But if you don't look at her foot,
but those leaves are gorgeous.
Yeah, it's always gorgeous. We are getting that time of year. I'm hoping that I have a special tree in my front yard that turns like blazing red. But the last few years, every time right when it turned the perfect shade of red that I was getting ready to take a picture of it, we'd get a storm come through and blow all the leaves off. So I'm hoping this year that I'm going to get some good photo ops on my red tree because we've had no water. Yay, California. We also got a shot of Frank smoking a pipe in a dapper manner.
I thought
manner.
You were going to say Frank smoking.
No.
Smoking Frank.
Smoking a pipe in a dapper manner. I think that's the scene where he's explaining how to get through an interrogation.
Mm-hmm. Did you see her hair?
I didn't even see her hair, but you noticed it. I was distracted by the camera and this pipe smoke, but good for you. Where do you go, Ginger? We also got the 4th of November has come, and the 4th of every month, they will now be releasing behind-the-scenes footage, and this month, on the 4th, they released an extended scene, basically. It was an extended scene of episode 2, I think, for Castleleok, when she is leaving the stable area.
After having brought some food to Jamie.
Yes. And sort of the conversation, the back and forth between she and Rupert, and a majority of the scene
we
have already seen. It was included in the episode, but it was a cute little scene with Rupert where you got to see a little bit more of that character that we don't see yet, because he gets fleshed out a lot more as the series progresses.
Mm-hmm.
But this kind of gives you a little bit more of an idea of his character before we see more. But I thought it was a cute little addition thing that we got. Honestly, we're happy to get anything new ever at this point, because we know that April is a very long ways away. And now on to our read-along.
So for our next chapter discussion in our DIA Dragonfly and Amber read-along, we have two very special guests, actually back to the show, friends of the show and guests of the show, and they are Diane and Arlen.
Hi, guys.
Yay, they're back. Yay. So how have you guys been the last few months?
Pretty good. Really busy.
Yeah, it's been good. I started grad school for Sirius this fall, so I've been busy with that. And
hold on a second. Did you just say for Sirius?
For Sirius, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I say that, too, but I also say for cereal.
Oh, for
cereal. So, I love it. So it's the same thing. But I like that for Sirius. I'm so glad someone else said that. Okay.
So I'm working on a master's degree in public policy and administration. And it's been, I took a class over the summer and it was not too bad. And so I kind of got comfortable. But this semester has been much more of a challenge. So that's been most of my time doing that other than being at work. So, yeah, it's been good.
And your young Scotsman near you?
Yeah.
I started a new job.
Woo-hoo!
Which is really good, and most of my time has been taking up with a large portion of incredibly nerdy hobbies.
Aw, but isn't that the life?
It kind of is. You know, the other weekend we went to our medieval reenactment demo, and then we went to a Scottish country dancing demo, and then we drank snooty beer while watching Doctor Who with friends.
Aww. The nerd trifecta, right?
So you started a new job, so I want to know how long the novelty of your accent lasted.
I don't know that it was ever even novel to them.
Did anybody mention it?
Not really. The place I work, it's a medical clinic, and so we have a lot of staff from all over the world. So I think it was just another foreigner.
You need a new job then, because that's part of the perks of having a great accent. Over by strangers when you start there. You're in an office where there are a good number of other non-native, excuse me, I will call you a non-native English speaker.
According to the USCIS, the immigration folk, my first language is Scots and my second language is English.
Really? Well, that's
actually... Yeah, they consider him bilingual. I think that's so cool.
That's actually... let me say it. It's a good thing. That's actually kind of sexy. But here's the question. If your first language is Scots, do you really actually speak English then?
When I'm talking to Americans.
Okay, fine. I guess we fall into that category. Okay, so glad to hear that all has been mostly on the up and up and on the busy up and up for the two of you. And let's get to our read-along.
Yay!
So this, I know, huh? Finally! So this was chapter 5. Summer, what was chapter 5 called?
Beloved Wife.
Yeah, that was
I almost said chapter 4.
Beloved Wife. The chapter opens at the churchyard of St. Kilda. Mm-hmm. And Connie, another listener, points out, there are no saints named Kilda.
The origin of the name St. Kilda is a matter of conjecture. The island's human heritage includes numerous unique architectural features.
May have been derived from the Norse Sunt Kilda, which means sweet well water, apparently.
Oh, there you go.
So Connie points out there are no saints named Kilda, but the name St. Kilda is used to refer to an isolated island archipelago in the North Atlantic Ocean, and it is named St. Kilda. It contains the westernmost islands of the Outer Hebrides of Scotland.
Is that because she wanted to make sure it wasn't the name of a real, like she was just trying to pick something
anonymous? Oh, well, that's actually
a smart
thing.
Well,
yeah.
It would be a smart thing. Maybe she didn't know that there wasn't really a St. Kilda, but, I mean, maybe, actually probably she would because she's Catholic, but let me go around in circles a little bit more, but it seems like that could be one of the reasons why she would pick that for the name of a church is because it seems unlikely there'd really be a church named after that, especially in, like, mainland Scotland.
Well, the assumption is that, I mean, no one wants to assume they have a bunch of fans, but if you have a bunch of fans who are looking for, to go and visit the places that they see, they're not going to find a place that has all of these things in it that she's describing, so it's easier just to give it a name of something that doesn't actually exist. So, I mean, that makes sense to me.
Yeah, and, you know, if you're writing and you want to imagine somewhere that sort of fits the needs of your storyline, then I can see a lot of utility, especially if you haven't been to Scotland yet or you don't have time to do the amount of research that you'd like to do, to just say, okay, I'm just going to pick one, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But sorry, I get all into the literary analysis stuff. I find that...
Oh, just wait.
I kind of feel like it's probably the same as, you know, there are so many established standing stones, even in that area, that she could have used, but she made up her own circle of standing stones with its own name.
And its own attributes. There's lots of reasons, I'm sure. Maybe someday we'll get to ask her.
Well, I mean, I feel like you never know what's going to be trademarked or
somebody
can try to grab onto and be like, you can't discuss our standing stones.
Mm-hmm.
Those are ours. She would like to lay claim to things.
You know, I visited someone I was over there that were on private property, so I suppose I guess you could own your own if you wanted.
There is such a thing as private property with the right to roam?
Mm-hmm.
How does that work? Well, I think the right to roam is on public property, right?
Well, there's like, you have to provide a right-of-way. There are certain restrictions about it for hikers or walkers that you have to provide right-of-way. And there's some sort of, if you have a historic something on your property, you have to provide some access to the public, even if it's just, you know, a couple hours a week during this specific time or, you know, I'm not exactly clear on all the restrictions, but I know they let us into their fields to go look at the stones. So,
okay, so the scene is set. We are in an old graveyard whose graves are dilapidated and many in ruin. It's not a flat place at all. Rather, it is sloped and gravestones are hidden in hollows. Okay, this is the first line, and I warned Summer earlier with In Glee, that there's a little bit of, or a lot of, okay, a little bit of symbolism that I kind of went on to here.
Oh,
okay.
My God.
A row of giant yew trees served as a, quote, windbreak against storms from the sea. Here, the yew is described in a protective role. The yew tree. Granted, this is not the most academic site. What'syoursign.com? It's about tree symbolism.
Mm-hmm.
Celtic tree symbolism. Okay. So the yew is a loner. Its isolated occurrences would have piqued the Celt's interest because solo elements in nature are unique and thus granted special study. The evocative and dark twists of the yew gives it an otherworldly presence. Its reputation is as an otherworldly oracle. This is quotes from that speech, and I will give the link in our blog post. The symbolism of the yew deals with longevity. New yews are born from existing systems. The oldest yew is known to be at least 3,000 years of age. Shields and weaponry made from the yew were highly admired by the Celts and were considered extremely auspicious on the battlefield. Tools used for divination or spiritual rites were made of yew to augment the energetic atmosphere of the ceremony or procedure. It was thought the other world would whisper through yew staves during rituals and initiations. Finally, quote, it's interesting to note the paradox of longevity juxtaposed to the yew's poisonous nature to humans. The Celts no doubt knew its lethal ways and counted this among its many attributes. This aspect of death, or mortality, played against its symbolic longevity, or immortality, would add tremendous strength to the symbolism of the yew, ranking it highly sacred among the spiritual clans as well as the Ogham. And just a little interesting tidbit, although it's not good news, a BBC report from February of this year tells of a man who died from ingesting yew berries. So this is still applicable. People don't eat them.
Well, part of what's interesting about yew trees is the berries themselves, the fruit themselves are not poisonous, but the seeds inside them are. And
oh,
so you hear stories. I heard some documentary podcast a while back that, you know, of course I can't remember the name of it, but they talked about that people, it used to be pretty common that yew berries were known to be edible as long as you got the seeds out, and they just have one big seed, but because that was so frequently not done right, you know, they gained a reputation for the whole fruit being poisonous. But yeah, yew trees are really common. They're almost always planted in churchyards and cemeteries in the UK. They're everywhere, and some of the oldest ones in the UK are in churchyards.
Mm-hmm.
They're one of my sort of favorite trees. And Norse mythology and symbolism has a lot of the same. They apply a lot of the same characteristics to the yew, that it's a tree that's considered very strong, very solitary, and really long-lived and sort of protective almost. So,
yeah.
But also definitely associated with the dead and with the other world. So very deliberate on her part, I thought, to write about that.
What I found interesting was yew trees are not as common in the north of Scotland
mm-hmm.
as they are in south and central Scotland. So like south and central Scotland, you'll see them around churchyards a lot, but not so much in the north. And in the north, it tends to be hawthorn trees, which in Celtic mythology and in general neo-paganism are considered to be a gateway to the other world. So when I read it, I did find it kind of interesting that she's got the yew trees, because that kind of, you know, it makes
it
a bit more of a special place.
Yeah.
Well, the poisonous nature of the seeds isn't that surprising to me, considering a lot of fruit has arsenic in their pits.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not too surprising, but it's like you wouldn't think of grabbing like an apricot and eating the whole thing.
No,
whereas
exactly.
Maybe a berry, you might throw it in your mouth. So that makes sense to me.
And the yew, the reason I went into so much detail is because of that, and I quoted, no, for serious. The reason I did so much detail is because Diana does not just describe the fact that there are yew trees here. She mentions it about four times
mm-hmm.
in different ways,
especially
in different roles.
Claire.
And so,
yeah.
Exactly. So it keeps coming back. So I wanted to, before I, you know, said, oh, there's the yew again, I wanted to make sure the first time it was mentioned, it's a protective role of this church of the dead. And so, of course, it can't harm the dead. It's protecting the dead.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first reference that she gives us. And I also, in reading, I had to look up a light gate, Or Lich Gate.
Yeah. I've always heard it said Lich Gate.
Lich Gate, okay. Yeah. So it's a gate to a graveyard. So a Lich Gate, also spelled a number of other ways, is a gate covered with a roof found at the entrance to a traditional English or English-style churchyard. And examples exist also outside the British Isles, such as Sweden. Now, in the etymology of this word, it is from Old English, L-I-C. I'm not sure if that is Lich or Lick or what it is, but it is Old English meaning corpse. The modern German word for corpse is die Leiche, L-E-I-C-H-E. You can see totally the relationship the etymology, etymological development of that word. Mm-hmm. It's very, very neat that it kept that. Yet the modern English uses the French, which is from the Latin. So it's very, very interesting. The site, meaning the entire site, both the church as well as the graveyard, is deconsecrated. And so I wondered to myself, does that mean the ground is no longer hollow? It's the removal of a sacred character of something. Mm-hmm. And the example the dictionary gave was to deconcentrate.
Concentrate? What?
I've taken a lot of chemistry, and that's not impossible. I guess you do.
You dilute just, you make it. Is that what happens?
Yeah, thank you. Deconcentrate is to dilute. Thank you. Oh, Lord have mercy. Okay.
Well, are we the only ones drinking? Is that what's going on?
No, you are. Summer is drinking, and are both of you?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, Thank God. You're the only sober one.
Don't put your finger in my mouth.
Jar.
She pointed at me and, like, basically gave me, gave me a mouth.
I didn't touch you. I didn't physically
you
touch
almost
you.
Almost did. Gracious.
I have a little bit of notion of spatial relation.
Not so much. So, are you okay?
Oh my God, somebody pat him on the back.
He broke Arlen.
Oh.
What?
That's what she said.
What did I say?
Don't put your finger in my mouth.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That's...
Now I really wish there was video.
Oh, no, never, ever.
If anyone would have seen that my finger was nowhere near her mouth and she was overreacting.
No. It was not in my mouth. It were like a centimeter and you were way too close. So then the line, and Diana describes a little bit more of the church. Ancient carvings decorated door sill and window frame, some showing symbols of Christianity, some obviously much older. And this makes me think of the Sheila na Gigs in Ireland, which, Summer, is where the vulva comes in.
What?
I told Summer there would be vulvular discussion.
Vulvular discussion. Yeah.
She did. And she said,
she goes, no, there's no vulva involved. I'm like, well, I can make it involved.
In every chapter we read, I could make something naughty involved, but I don't.
Diana's a very earthy writer, you know?
Exactly. Now, she didn't mention it, but if you've seen anything, this is where your mind first goes to. Mm-hmm.
Really?
So the Sheila na Gigs are figurative carvings of naked women displaying an exaggerated vulva. Not just exaggerated, they're full on
like,
showing, they're full
the
on pulling
their body.
Open.
Yeah.
Well, let's go ahead and give it its proper description.
Oh, dear.
Oh, go ahead.
You're ready to cut this part out.
Sheila na Gigs, you get them in churches all over Scotland, cathedrals, everything. And they're usually depicted as a woman with her arms reaching underneath her legs and assuring that everything is visible.
Yep.
Is the nicest way I can put it.
That's what I said, pulling it open.
Yeah.
Yeah, or wide, like widening it, yeah.
Definitely very old symbolism, and mm-hmm. It's always a surprise to see these, you know, going around these old churches and to see crosses and saints, and then suddenly there's one of those, and there's a green man, and you're like, well, okay, they didn't, you know, they were kind of trying to maintain all of their connections just in case, you know,
exactly.
Backup deities.
Exactly. So Roger and Brianna are making their way through the stones. I wrote LOL. Roger had told her about Jonathan Randall's grave, and she's anxious to see it, saying that her father had been really interested in him and admired him. Then Roger asks if Claire will need help with the plant press, and this is the first way we know that Claire's actually there with them. Mm-hmm. So we know she is there somewhere. As the pair continue to walk around, Roger shows her William Watson's gravestone's inscription. For here lies Bailey William Watson, who was famous for his thinking and moderation in his drinking. And I just love that. I don't know if that's real or if Diana made that up 100%, but you know what? Some of the most entertaining things you'll read, you can read, are on gravestones.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We actually, there's a graveyard right next to my synagogue, which has a Jewish section. And one of the women who passed away about 10 years ago was very well loved in the community. She was an elementary school teacher, and she was always helping out every kid in the synagogue. And she got ovarian cancer very suddenly and died quite soon afterwards. And at her request, her gravestone just says in really big letters, "Damn ovarian cancer."
That's very, it's, I don't think it's funny, but it's very touching, but it's, it kind of gives her the last word, you know?
She, and that was what her personality was like, definitely. But those 18th century, they really seemed to like that kind of goofy, poetic grave marker stuff in the 18th and 19th centuries. And there's lots of good, great cemeteries in that part of the world that are full of that stuff. So I wouldn't be surprised if she pulled that off of a real marker.
We learned that the church had been deconsecrated in 1800, so all graves would likely be 18th century and earlier. Claire is all up in her greens, and Brianna sees a stone and calls her mom to come look at it. Claire sees the name and lets out a JHRC. She goes pale, crushes the plant in her hand, and Roger asks her if she's all right, and she replies, "I'm fine," and then stoops to run her fingers over the letters, Jonathan Wolverton Randall, 1705 to 1746. "I told you, didn't I? You bastard, I told you." Whoa, Nellie.
This is funny for me because I'm imagining Brianna and Roger being like, "Oh, look at this cool thing we found. You'll be able to find the connection in this." And her getting up there and being like, What?
Oh, I know. And it really seems like that first moment where Brianna's like, okay, maybe I'm the one taking care of my mom, not the other way around. Like,
well, I always wondered, like, what must they be thinking at that point in time? And the best I can come up with is that they're seriously thinking, well, she must have been arguing with Frank about this for decades. They must have argued about where he was buried or his date of death or something. Because, you know, human beings, we tend to, when someone does or says something really weird, we do try and figure out an excuse for it. And I can only imagine that they're really trying to figure out an excuse for why she's suddenly swearing at a gravestone.
They didn't try for very long, though.
Yeah.
Like, she didn't even try, though. No one tried. She didn't even cover it very well.
No,
and Brianna's just like, "All right, Mom, you've been in the sun too long."
Listener Teresa Kay says, "I absolutely love that Claire shouts, seemingly at the ghost of BJR, 'I told you, didn't I?' etc. Claire's protective shell mentioned in the last chapter is cracking indeed."
Mm-hmm. Very well put.
Brianna freaks a little bit out, and asks her if she's all right. Claire snaps back to the here and now and says that, yes, she's okay. Brianna trying to confirm that it was the relative that died at Culloden. Claire replies, "Yes, it is, and he is dead, isn't he?" Roger and Brianna are exchanging looks. They try to get her to go into the church with them, where it's cooler. She demurs and goes to sit under a tree, saying she'll be fine. Brianna and Roger go into the church and look at the internal architecture. They discuss the image of St. Kilda, how it was likely a pagan image before it was Christian. Brianna looks at the carving and says it looked like some Pictish stones outside Clava.
Mm-hmm.
They continue to walk through the church, past the ledge where the altar stone would have been. Quote, "Roger felt something of a quiver up his spine as he stood beside Brianna, facing the vanished altar. I wonder what that might mean."
I know.
He is happy she can't hear his thoughts. When he does look at her, her face is serious as well. He reaches for her and they kiss. And I wrote in all caps, "In front of the altar!"
Yeah.
Quote, "As striking in its impact as though they had this minute plighted a troth."
There's so much I'd like to say about this in light of what happens in later books.
Teresa Kay writes, "The scene inside the old church is so well described by the author. I can picture myself standing there. I love that Bree and Roger's first kiss is at the altar, or where it would have been had it lasted. I hope that this is a foreshadowing of the future of their relationship." Well, now. So I love Diana's description of the air in the church. "The still air of the church shivered suddenly into bits. The echoes of a scream scattering the dust mote."
I like that imagery.
So do I. Yeah, I think of this air that you cannot see, like starting to, I mean, you might see, you know, a mote flying here and there and whatever. Almost like, you know how when, it's not exactly the same, but at least in movies or in TV, when there's an earthquake or something happens and the camera shakes. Well, this would be not that the image shakes, but the air itself, in my mind, is shimmering. There's a disturbance in the air.
Right.
It's just such beautiful imagery.
Like a disturbance in the force.
Pretty much. Teresa Kay then shares, the afterglow of Bree and Roger's lovely first kiss is shattered by Claire's scream and Roger bolts outside. The first time I read this book, it bothered me that he took off without Brianna. The second time, I thought it was touching that he ran off to help Claire without waiting for Brianna. So a word, someone commented to the effect of, Roger seems to have something for Claire. And I honestly, at least in a certain part or early on at some point, not a crush, doesn't want to ravish her, but...
like an appreciation. From the he's like, wow, this is a gorgeous woman. And
I mean, an appreciation at the very least. but I don't know how high it goes, but I know it does not go any lower than appreciation.
Right.
But because it's not just now when he met her on his doorstep, when he had the... you know, the indecent thoughts of her and her redheaded lover in the scrying bathtub. It's all these potential... Slipper's giving me weird face. It happens again and again. I mean, let's just say Roger's appreciation, quote-unquote, for Claire and her beauty continues through the entire series. That's all I'm going to say.
I think he acknowledges... it's more of an acknowledgement of the fact that she is a woman who has maintained herself.
I didn't say he wanted to do her.
But I think he also acknowledges that she's got this kind of magnetism, this sort of power about her, and as she sort of comes into herself, I think it's first of all, I bet part of it has to do with the fact that he did not grow up really being a beautiful woman in her prime. He was around Mrs. Graham. And, you know, to be around this woman who is so different from these sort of Scottish housewives he's met, this woman who is educated and confident and, you know, large and in charge and also just gorgeous and knows it and uses it, like, I can imagine him just sort of being like, this is a force of nature and I don't know what to do, but I kind of like it, you know?
Absolutely. And so as Teresa said, he runs outside, not waiting for Brianna. Claire is completely drained of color. Quote, she looked like a wraith against the dark branches of the what? The yew.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so remember all the things I said about the yew tree? It's poisonous, but also of long life. Diana writes, she looked like a wraith against the dark branches of the yew. She didn't say tree. She brought our attention to the fact it was the yew tree again.
Mm-hmm.
This time, it seems its role is anything but protective. Claire has collapsed to her knees and stretching out her hand to the surface of the stone. In his concern for Claire, Roger asks her, is it a name you know? And then realizes what this is asking. No one's been buried here since the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
The next lines bring tears to my eyes.
Me too. Diana's.
Oh my God. I mean, whew. Claire's fingers brushed his own away and touched the stone, caressing, as though touching flesh, gently tracing letters, the grooves worn shallow but still clear. James Alexander Malcolm Mackenzie Fraser, she read aloud. Yes, I know him. Her hand dropped lower, brushing back the grass that grew thickly about the stone, obscuring the line of smaller letters at its base. Beloved husband of Claire, she read. Yes, I knew him, she said again. I'm Claire. He was my husband and your father. Man, my nose is already tingling. So Roger and Brianna stared down at her, and the kirkyard was silent, save for the rustle of the yews above.
I think she wants us to pay attention to that.
Just a little bit. So, okay, first, yews were rustling.
So does Ginger.
Just a little bit.
FYI.
So first, the yews were rustling, right? This is so many things to me right now. I mean, we know kind of, there was a hint, I think, one or two chapters ago about the whole gravestone thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we won't say again what it is, but I think there's a hint about it. So this may or may not be a real gravestone where this person is maybe buried or not buried, but...
that's not what Claire thinks, though.
Exactly. No, she totally thinks it is. Claire has no idea about this whole facade. So she's freaking out, of course, as anyone would. But this is this is so many things. It's not just her, it's her reaction, that the ewes rustling right at this moment. I mean, whew, you know, fake gravestone or not, there is something going on here.
Mm-hmm. And whether it's just, I mean, you know how sometimes in movies you'll have that moment where it's really still and something important happens and then the wind starts blowing? Like, yeah. That's what this makes me feel like, is that there's this, you know, they talk about how still the air is and how quiet it is and the bright sun, and then you see Claire's pale self highlighted against these trees that are almost black, and it's mm-hmm. so still and so quiet, and then suddenly the idea of the wind blowing, that to me feels yeah. like not just the wind, you know, like something else is going on, and I think that's definitely her point, is to make us feel the eeriness of that moment and the emotionality of that moment.
You know,
agreed.
If you guys have got about 5 minutes, I'd like to go off on a bit of a...
Sure, always.
Not really a tirade, but...
Oh, go ahead.
So, bring it. I ain't afraid.
He just refilled my wine, so he can talk for a little while now.
Oh. Okay, then.
It's a good marriage. There's like a third of a bottle left. I'm ready.
All right, go. Tirade.
I haven't really experienced it here, and I wouldn't go so far as to say it's not something that happens in America. I'm sure it does. It's just I haven't been to any places yet that have it. There are certain places in Scotland, at least for me, places I've been, where things are remarkably still.
Mm.
And it's really hard to describe, but it's just places where things are quiet, even if there is a slight breeze, even if there are birds outside, whatever, it's very quiet and still. And so Roger and Brianna having that whole imagery with them kissing before the altar that's not there, and, you know, all of the imagery of maybe it's too soon because the altar's not there and all of that stuff, and then the silence is broken. And in those places, something like that, something like a sudden scream would be so entirely out of place, it would completely shatter the air around you. And then, like, when it goes on, the description of, you know, Claire pale against the yew trees, and you said, you know, the yews are no longer protective. For me, it's more like, it's almost like they're there to protect her from what a huge thing this is. And like you said, the description where she's touching the gravestone and everything, this is so momentous, because this is 20 years, more than 20 years, of desperately trying to bury possibly the most important part of her life and pretend like it never existed and pretend like she's a different person. And, you know, she's become this hospital administrator, and she's strong and cold and clinical and in charge, and suddenly something breaks through and shatters 20 years of hard work in just a moment with just a few words on a rock. And it really is very touching, because this is like Claire at the most vulnerable you'll see her.
Well, because she hasn't had time to shut that part of herself down. I mean, she shut herself down.
Yeah, uh-huh. And this is a really, it's like a Freudian, you know, repressive state that she's in. And, you know, yeah, she's just been confronted with the thing that she's been avoiding for so long. And she found him, you know, and maybe she kind of talks about how she's not, well, she thinks earlier in the book about how she's not really sure what she wants to find and or if she wants to know and what, you know, and she's so sure that he died at Culloden, and yet she's still so shocked when she's confronted with the reality that that his gravestone's right in front of her, mm-hmm. you know?
Well, and this may be a bit spoilery, so feel free to cut it. It's interesting to me that when she's sitting there at the stone and she's reading off the text on the stone, you go from Blackjack's stone where it says, you know, pretty much exactly where and when he died, to the stone that all it says on there is, you know, James Alexander Malcolm Mackenzie Fraser, beloved husband of Claire. And that's it. That's the entire stone. You know, mm-hmm. that's the entirety of what's important at this point.
Yeah, but no date of death. So mm-hmm. so Claire doesn't get any farther in her search to find out what happened to Jamie and his men. Although, you know, she is very sure that she knows what happened to Jamie, and she just wants to know what happened to everybody else when she first contacts Roger. So,
I just want to go back for a second and talk about the fact that their first kiss was interrupted by her mother screaming. I can't imagine my first kiss with a really hot anyone,
you know,
being interrupted by my mother screaming. I think that that would be, like, really, would set me back a few paces.
And maybe this is what I was wanting to try and say earlier that I couldn't formulate it, or I missed my exact wording. Ginger, back up, because you can't say it because it is too spoilery. Yeah.
Well, it's just, like, I don't know about you guys, but I've definitely been in relationships where I got into the relationship and then the rest of my life kind of went down the toilet. And it really changes the nature of your relationship. And right from the very beginning of Brianna and Roger knowing her, they are both sucked into all these other things that don't have... that they're only related to tangentially. And the way that they both deal with that internally and the way they both deal with that as far as how they relate to each other really defines what happens in this book, you know? Because just like Claire and Jamie's relationship, they don't get a lot of, well, let's just sit here and have a nice time on the farm, you know? There's always something else going on, and then the relationship is sort of in the background of that.
Well, they always do that, let's sit back on the farm, briefly.
Yeah.
And then something steps in and says, nope.
Right, just to give you an idea of what you're missing.
Exactly.
So LNG writes, the rhythm of this chapter is very interesting. It's quiet, Claire reacting to BJR's grave. Quiet, Claire reacting to Jamie's grave. Long, short, and strong. Long, short, and strong. I thought it was very interesting to look at the rhythm of this.
Very true. Yeah, and I think all through the series, you see those kind of pairings. I know Diana talks a lot about groups of three and all the different threes in her books, but the contrast between Claire and Galus in the first book and Jamie and Blackjack, and then there's the sort of contrast between Roger and Jamie and Brianna and Jamie. There's these characters that I think are intentionally given a lot of similarities, not just because they're related to each other or in relationships with each other, but I think it's a very astute comment, because there are so many places where Blackjack is basically set up as the opposite of Jamie, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So fast forward a bit, and they're trying to get her to drink. They're back at the manse, and she's not having any of it, and she's not losing her mind. They'd brought her back, and they were pretty sure she was a little bit loony bins. Of course, it's medicinal whiskey, wink, wink. Okay, so Ellen points out the first part of the chapter is not in the first person, Claire's voice, and then when they are back in town, it's back in her voice again.
Mm-hmm.
Claire is upset, but she's not crazy town.
I felt like this was a lot like Diana trying to write the story in the first place, where she was trying to whip Claire into shape, and I felt like this chapter started with Diana trying to tell the story, and then midway through, Claire's like, F you, tell my story. This is what I have to say.
So Claire is upset. She hadn't meant to tell Brianna this way, but now that it had happened, well, she's got to change her plan. She expresses her anger to Jamie. Damn you, Jamie Fraser, what are you doing there anyway? It's miles from Culloden. And that just makes them more sure that she's loopy. So she gains control over herself again, and she prays that she can just tell them the truth. And then she recollects, I'd told the truth once before, and it hadn't gone well.
Mm-hmm.
She has memory of the hospital she was in after she'd come back to the 20th century. Connie writes, Diana has said that to evoke an idea of a particular place, a writer's description does that best when at least three of the five senses are invoked. And that's very true. Diana speaks of this a lot. And she does so in the next paragraph. Quote, I pressed my eyelids shut more tightly. Once more, I could smell the carbolic surroundings of a hospital and feel the unfamiliar starched pillowcase beneath my cheek. From the corridor outside came Frank's voice, choked with baffled rage. So this is when she's in the hospital after returning to the 20th century, and this is an example of those three senses.
Mm-hmm.
And she remembers Frank's rage. What do you mean, don't press her? My wife's been gone for nearly 3 years and come back filthy, abused, and pregnant, for God's sake, and I am not to ask questions? We learn that Claire had told the truth, and that she had heard the doctor using the words delusion and traumatic state outside her room. Her description of how she dealt with the feelings those 20 years ago, quote, I had curled my body into a defensive ball, pillow clutched against my chest, and bitten it as hard as I could until I felt the cotton casing give way and the silky grit of feathers grinding between my teeth.
Yeah.
Really kind of gross. So Brianna was still freaked out, but Roger, Diana describes, quote, had lost that green about the gills look and was exhibiting signs of interest.
Mm-hmm.
She tells them about the stones. Brianna is still freaking out.
Well, of course he's excited. He's like a mixture of like a scientist and a little bit of like an earthy occultist, kind of like he's open to learning about anything. So that makes more sense to me. Whereas Brianna is more like acoustics. I want to learn about scientific things. And
so Brianna's
too. Brianna, I mean, like I forget how young she is here. She's been very sheltered by her parents.
And this is the worst way to find out that your dad is not your dad.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I'm sure she's so busy with her mind going a million miles an hour, whereas Roger's kind of already started putting pieces together, and he's a historian, and he's also had a little more experience with the world. And so, of course, I mean, he's going, all right, I want to hear the next part of the story.
He also already knew that Frank was not her father.
Yeah,
into this, that part wasn't a shock, and Brianna's not letting go of that yet. So she's still like, what do you mean my dad's not my dad?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Roger's like, I already knew that. This is a lot more interesting.
Well,
this is more of a turn than I expected, but I'm totally with you. Let's go.
You know, from a guy brain viewpoint, you know, I'm sure that Brianna's just sitting there worrying about, holy shit, my mom's going insane. And how do you even deal with that? And Roger, you know, like, backing up for a second in the hospital, that's almost very progressive the way they were talking to Frank and saying, you know, just leave her alone, delusions, let her mind work it out, we don't want to break her fragile mind. Because in that time it was very much still, at least as far as I know, a lot of the medical reactions to someone having a delusion was sit them down and explain to them why their brain is wrong. And
they don't do that today?
Actually, a lot. Like, one of the things they do with Alzheimer's patients now is they're starting to progress more towards, you know, just explaining to the family members if they're having this delusion, don't keep trying to pull them out of it. Don't keep trying to tell them how wrong they are. Just, you know, be there and enjoy being with them and let their brain work the way it's going to work.
I think it depends on the situation a lot, too. But I think in the hospital, the other thing is that Claire being Claire, she's not budging an inch. And she's not super concerned about what other people think at that point because she's just gone through, like, the most traumatic event of her life. So, but...
And so, yeah, Roger, you know, yes, he's a historian and all of that. But he's also, I think... I get the feeling he's kind of treating this as, okay, there's something interesting going on here. I'm going to find out this, whatever this weird thing I've suspected all along is. But at the same vein, I kind of get the feeling he's doing that sort of, oh, you poor hysterical fainting lady.
Oh, I don't get that.
Let me
at
give
all.
You some whiskey and we'll just chat about whatever this drama is.
I don't think so. I don't buy it.
So Roger is, as we've all said, Roger is growing more interested. Whatever his reason, he is at least expressing interest. Claire tells us how Frank had reacted to the same words that she had just told them. Quote, I walked through a bloody cleft stone in that circle in 1945 and ended up on the hillside below in 1743.
Though for the serious, I'll say, I touched the center stone in a ring of stones and I traveled through time. There's
for the serious, yes, got it. So Frank had reacted such, or in such
Can
a way.
Can you imagine, though? What else would you do?
No, hold, I haven't said it yet.
Okay.
Girl, stop bringing down my vibe.
I have opinions.
Shush. After the fact, yes.
Well, let's be fair. I'm incredibly, incredibly superstitious to a ridiculous degree.
You should be, your Scottish.
Yes.
So much so that my wife makes fun of me for it. But if someone were to come up to me and go, I totally travelled back in time 200 years and met a handsome Highlander and had a baby and then came back and had my ex-husband, who I abandoned, bring the baby up, and now we're telling you about it. I would think there was something wrong.
You would think that was a day ending in Y, like a Tuesday.
So Frank has smashed a vase of flowers onto the floor.
She's ignoring me.
Not ignoring you, I'm just trying to go on. Diana again describes Roger's growing interest. Quote, Roger looks like a scientist whose new microbe has come through a winner.
Guys, I love that line.
Calling something a growing interest when referring to a gender is inappropriate.
Oh, I forgot that.
Ellen G. writes, Roger is the vehicle that keeps Claire grounded as she explains her experiences. She has a rapt audience. And that's very true. Because without Roger, she wouldn't have the oomph or whatever, the someone kind of encouraging her mm-hmm. and to pull it out of her.
And just listening, yeah. I think he can tell, too, by her behavior that whatever's going on, she's not confused about what she's saying at all. And okay. And he's seen this list of names that she's given him and gone, okay, so she clearly knows something. She's got some connection to this, so.
But let's think of how lucky Bree is at this point to have someone like Roger be the third wheel here.
Oh, so much.
Had it been someone who was like, dude, your mom's crazy.
Cray-cray.
Dial 999 right now.
But he's almost the rational one in this conversation. He's like, oh, really? Tell me more. As opposed to if there'd been anyone else, they would have been like, Brianna, seriously, your mom is a little bit wackadoo. Maybe we need to take her someplace and get her.
Claire says that the first person she ran into was an English dragoon, BJR. She tells him about the captain and how he was a, quote, bloody, filthy pervert.
Yes, and for everyone who I'm sure has read the first book already, sit down, get comfortable. You already know all of this.
Yes. She tells about her marriage of convenience to Jamie, but how he was the one that BJR actually wanted. She said Jamie was kind to have done it. The marriage. Not BJR. And then she remembers...
She didn't do
hold
that
on.
For kindness.
And then she remembers episode 107. I'm just kidding. She remembers their wedding night. She describes her capture, her unsuccessful efforts to escape, how she had told Jamie the truth, he'd taken her to the stones, the witch trial at Cranesmere, and yes, I'm out of order. Quote, I paused remembering that October afternoon where control of my destiny, taken from me for so long, had been suddenly thrust back into my hands. Her decision to stay, their flight to Lallybroch. Jamie was an outlaw. He was captured. She helped him get out. Their flight to France, and then saving his life. Connie writes, Claire remembers how she fought for Jamie's soul at the Abbey and muses that, quote, there is very little difference between medicine and magic when it comes to some kinds of healing.
I have a lot of things to say about this particular conversation that she's having in her head about that night mm-hmm. in the Abbey when she had that fight.
Taking her singing in the Abbey.
No.
I just re-listened to that show the other day.
Oh, love, love, love. I played a nun.
My point being, having read this book and knowing what happens in the course of it, finding her reminiscing about fighting for his soul in the Abbey is a little bit her trying to raise that ghost in the Abbey. Considering the fact that we all know what happened in the course of this book is a little bit comedic to me.
Hmm.
I just think it's comedic. Knowing the fact that we all know that she perhaps did not raise a ghost.
Or a goat.
Or a goat. She definitely didn't raise
didn't
a goat.
Didn't raise a goat.
I would stand by that 100%.
So Brianna is having none of it. Claire flat out says that Frank wasn't her father, and she doesn't believe her. For the sake of her health and her pregnancy, Frank had stopped pressing her for the information, and she'd stopped sharing. And she'd promised Frank 20 years before not to tell her, Brianna, that he wasn't her father.
But could you imagine how frustrating that is? Because she was telling him the truth, and he just said, like, stop lying to me. Tell me the truth.
Oh, I can't imagine.
Like, for how many years?
Well, I can't imagine.
No.
But, yeah, that's a horrible feeling, not being believed when you're being honest with someone.
And she did keep that promise as long as he lived, and he had said, after that, after I'm gone, it's up to you what to do. And so she tells Brianna to go to the National Portrait Gallery to see the pic of, I put pic, to see the, not quite a picture, to see the portrait of Ellen McKenzie, Jamie's mother, and her grandmother. And she's like, you know, if you just, okay, first of all, you don't look like your dad. You don't look like your dad, but you do look like your father.
No.
You don't look like Frank,
yeah.
Exactly, but that was her dad. That was her daddy.
That was her daddy.
It was her daddy. It wasn't her father. Anyway, so Ellen G. writes, it was such a beautiful yet hard promise to keep to Frank about Bree's heritage, but really, can't she see that she looks nothing like a Randall?
Dude, everyone knows
Everyone
that.
Notices it.
Except Brianna.
Exactly. Yep. So Roger brings some newspaper clippings to Brianna to read. Claire describes his look as, quote, he didn't yet believe, but he had the imagination to doubt. And I really like that, because to me, that line, the imagination to doubt, mm-hmm. I mean, you could almost turn that around and say the imagination to have faith, because I look at that and saying, you know, someone who does not believe in, say, any kind of creator or any kind of anything, okay, you know, it's fair, it's fair dues, it's whatever you believe, but to me, it almost takes more imagination to have faith in something like that than it would to say, oh, no, it's not possible. Because, and I love Diana's wording here, because I know she's talking about the whole time travel thing and everything that they're about to, you know, go into in subsequent chapters. But I love that phrase. Because what does a scientist have? I mean, it's curiosity, but you could also slip in the word imagination. It's curiosity and imagination. Hi, puppy. To keep going and to find out more and believing or having imagination that there is something past the world that we see and can touch.
But I think that speaks to Roger's nature. Like he is a scholar, but he's not just a cut and dry historian, black and white scholar.
He's also an artist and a musician.
Yeah. So he's open, it seems, to more possibilities than just what you would find in nature.
Mm-hmm. And he's a Scot. He's a Scot from the Highlands. And he's grown up hearing stories and hearing Mrs. Graham's stories and being part of that world where, I mean, Arlen's a city boy from Glasgow, and he buys a lot of that superstition because it's just part of the air over there, you know?
You say buy it like it's not true.
Oh, well, we have different fairies here.
I'm not going to lie. I drove to Glasgow, and I was afraid to stop.
Mm-hmm. Don't fuck by yourself.
Bad things. And I said, keep driving. Even though I wanted
you have to drive through the right parts.
Exactly.
I was on the parts that were, like, the freeway. So I wasn't sure where that would be.
That goes through, like, Easter House and stuff. You don't want to go there.
So I was right.
Yeah.
Denniston. Where the churches have razor wire fences.
Anyway.
So, Claire says that, yes, she'd known the men who'd fought at Culloden, the ones on the list that she'd given him. And, yes, they'd gone to Paris to try to stop Charles Stuart. Whew, this chapter's a big old bang bang. And
well, this chapter makes me happy because we know that it's leading. Because
finally,
it's the end
yeah.
of part one. We know that it's leading us back to where we ended in the last book.
We're finally going to figure out how we got there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, part of why I really wanted to do this chapter, when you start this book, it is this massive jump from, you know, Jamie and Claire, she's just rescued him from his demons, they're in love, she's pregnant, they're going to go off to France and everything's going to be great. And it jumps from that to 20-odd years, and here's Claire with her daughter in the future again. And like when you start the book like that, I remember the first time I read it and opening up the book and Dan and I going through it, and I was just like, what is going on? Like, are we missing another book in the middle? Are you sure this is the right one? And this is the moment where everything starts to coalesce. And like I said, you have that huge breaking moment where Claire is suddenly completely vulnerable and has to tell this difficult and yet completely joyous truth. And it just is a phenomenal chapter. It starts to, like, this is where the story of this book really begins.
You know,
I totally agree. And part of me, I mean, can you imagine having that secret and being like, when should I bring this up? And then having it just, like, forced out of you, and you're like, well, at least it was done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I can almost feel like there's a certain relief in having it forced out of your body and not having to find that perfect moment.
Well, and to not be alone with that, to not be the only person in the entire world who knows what you've been through or, you know, who you are, really, because this is this... It's this huge defining part of her personality that, you know, not even her best friend really knew, you know?
True, and I have lots to say about her best friend, but we haven't been introduced to him yet.
Yeah,
so
no, we're not there yet.
Coming. Yeah, so that was kind of neat. It was very interesting. Yes, the rhythm of the chapter, especially the first bit until they get back to the manse, and the just beautiful, more tree symbolism that I can't, I guess I just can't leave alone. It's just so much. And a quick little shout out to @StoryWalk. They're doing an Outlander seminar right now, and I think they just had their third episode. Mm-hmm. And I've listened to a few of them, and he breaks them down really nicely. They're story experts, so they come at this from like tons of kind of like lit crit stuff. So it's really, really great
stuff.
To. Oh my gosh, you need to listen. So a little shout out for them. Just, it's so nice to hear that, because it is not my goal to sit there and totally break down a chapter as far as, you know, doing a really good job of lit crit stuff. That's not my training. That's not my background. I am just a fan who likes these books a lot. But we do, when I see something like, you know, the trees, I mean, like, come on now. So, you know, once in a while, I'll see something that is maybe a little bit obvious that I'll kind of delve into, and I might be right, I might be wrong, but it's just interesting to delve into so many of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're doing that. They're doing Outlander, and of course we're not going to get, I know, and of course we're not going to get ahead, because we're not going to get ahead, at least on our show, of the series too much. Well, I mean, we're not going to go on to other books on our show, on future books. Outside of the podcast and outside of following along as we can on with StoryWalk's seminar, I am personally on my own personal read-along, and I'm just now at a very critical part in The Fiery Cross, mm-hmm. which you might guess where I'm at. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I swear, I finished a read-along earlier this year I did another read-along real quick to get through so I can be ready for Moby, mm-hmm. and now I'm already back at book 5. Seriously, I'm going to be, like, done with the entire series.
You're a machine.
By like the first, no, I wouldn't say a machine. I do the audiobooks because I have a longer commute now. So mm-hmm. So I'm listening to Fiery Cross in the car, and like something will come up, or a little part that you're like, oh my gosh, I remember that, or whatever, or I don't remember that.
Right.
And you'll be sitting there, and just one of her descriptions, you'll just be like driving down the road, and all of a sudden you're like, dang it, Diana, dang it, Davina, and you have tears running down your face. You're like, I have to go to work. Stop it, dang you both.
Well, as Ginger knows, In my new job, I'm able to listen to audiobooks all day at work.
Mm.
And I just finished re-listening to Dragonfly and Amber. And the other day I was at work and got to, you know, the phenomenally difficult part towards the end of the book.
Tell me you cried.
I didn't cry, but only because Aww. This is like my fourth time.
Yeah,
so
whatever.
I steeled myself where I was like, I'm not going to cry in work because my boss might come in and this would be a lot to explain.
Was there a lot of heavy breathing? Like,
well, I had to go and make a new pot of tea.
Oh my goodness.
Most of those Arlen ever gets is I better go get some tea.
It was really hard. And the whole time I'd been re-listening, like I said, it was like my fourth time rereading this book, and yet there were still things where I was like, oh yeah, I forgot all about that. But this pivotal moment, even though I knew everything that had happened, even though I knew exactly what was leading up to it and how sudden and difficult and horrible it all is, I still was completely overwhelmed.
And I think that really speaks to Diana's ability to write in a way that's emotionally evocative. There are plenty of, you know, books or movies that I've encountered where the first time through they really move you, but there's very few authors who can do it every single time the way she does, you know, over and over, because she speaks to something so universal. You know, she really, that woman, I would love to spend a day inside her head, but I think it might drive me over the edge.
For serious. Now, I can't even tell you how many times I've read the second book, but I know that when I reach a certain point in the book, I kind of save it until I know for a fact that I'm going to have at least 30 minutes by myself. Because I don't need anyone watching the, like, aggressive crying. That
and
I'm
that's why
do
in the car, I mean, other than the fact you don't want to, you know, cry and get so many tears that you're going to, like, be distracted and, like, have an accident, obviously you don't want to have an accident, but other than that, the car is a good place to listen to it if you're by yourself, because no, you're there and no one, as long as you don't have to, like, as long as you're not going to, like, ruin your makeup.
Or unless you're worried about stop and go traffic or people.
Well, I don't care about stop and go traffic. It's the car. As long as I have more than, you know, a few minutes, I'm going to be there for a little bit. A car is a perfect place. But absolutely, when it comes to certain parts of these books, oh my gosh, it's like, if I had no privacy at home, I would purposefully, and I know I didn't have to drive anywhere, I'm not going to go on a fake drive, but, I'm not going to go in my car, I'm not going to go drive around for no reason except the book. But I will, like, go to a Starbucks or something and just to listen. I mean, I will get out of the house for privacy, except that then I don't want to cry in Starbucks.
I'm not going to lie, I'm one of those weirdos that reads, like, some of it aloud. Like,
Summer, I sub-vocalized everything.
No, I literally today, I'm going to put this out there and I'm not ashamed, I sat in my living room today and I read only Claire's parts aloud. Like, I was Claire for, like, 30 minutes.
Chapter?
Oh, yes. For, like, 30 minutes in my living room, I was Claire reliving the scene.
Listening to the accent?
Oh, yeah, totally. I totally committed to the accent. And for me, that's how I got into it. I was part of it, and I felt like I had, like, on Claire's behalf, I had, like, just the glistening of tears in my eyes for, like, 30 minutes. But I didn't fully commit to the cry because Claire wouldn't do that, but I was there.
Having your own little internal audition for the show, right?
Oh my God, yeah. I can't for believe Claire. They didn't hire me.
They really missed that.
No, Katrina's the bomb. So.
Katrina is so much better than I could be.
Oh gosh, these two have so exceeded my expectations, and my expectations
are real. Oh my God, I was rewatching that interview that we had with them on the plaid carpet in Los Angeles and
San Diego.
So jealous.
First of all, that was the only interview that was the only one that I led, and I felt like the whole time he was staring right at me, and I couldn't think of anything else but speaking to me. And I was like, and I was listening to it the other day, and I was thinking to myself, that was me trying to gather my thoughts, so I was rambling for like 2 minutes while I was trying to gather my thoughts, and if you listen.
I'm sure he totally was like, okay, I get this, everybody does the same thing.
Right? And I think if you listen, you can actually hear me gather my thoughts and then move on, but I rambled for like a good 3 minutes, but yeah.
I just have to say, though, like, I've met I've met several famous celebrity persons in my day, but that's not the same thing as, like, this is Jamie Fraser standing in front of me. Like, I cannot, I admire you guys' ability to stay collected in the face of, like,
it was not only Jamie Fraser, but it was also Claire Beecham, and it was at the same time, and they were both staring at me at the same time, and I was kind of casually throwing something out there, and I said, you know, well, I just sat and watched the first two episodes, and then Katrina interrupted me and said, oh, what did you think? And I was like, now I have to answer this question. And then, so I started answering the question, and while I'm answering the question, I'm trying to get back on track to what I was actually wanted to do, which was to ask them questions. So it took me probably 45 to a minute to come up with back to where I was, where I wanted to ask them a question. But if you listen, you'll hear it.
Oh,
it's funny.
We had it for about 3 minutes total.
There was about 45 seconds of me talking about how much I enjoyed the show, and I was really embarrassed about that.
I'm sure they love it, though. You know, I think probably no matter what line of work you're in, no matter how many times you hear it, I'm sure it's lovely to hear people say, this is magic, and you made that happen, and we appreciate you, you know?
I'm sure, but looking back, I'm a hella embarrassed about it. Put it out there.
So, that was the chapter.
Yes.
And let's do a little, because we've rambled a little bit, let's do a little close and get you guys off. Oh, that sounds
good. You know what? You can get each other off. This is not about us.
Oh, God. You're going to have to give Arlen a minute.
You have
Somebody
to keep up
Arlen
with them.
Summer's up.
Keep that part in.
No, I can't. Well, I might. We'll see. Okay, so we'll let you guys go and have your home to yourself again at a somewhat reasonable hour.
Oh.
So thank you, Diane and Arlen, so much for joining us. We hope that you guys had a decent little giggle of a time.
It was great. Thank you for having us.
But see, I want to put out there that you guys should read another chapter you like and come back, because this was fun for me.
Oh, I think we talked about that. I think you guys are coming back to somewhere near the end, right?
I think so.
So So thank you both so much again for joining us. We had a great time, and we have your word, or your good word that mm-hmm. you can think of another chapter to join us on, and that will be fun to have you guys back.
Yes.
Yeah, until then, we will see you on the interweb.
Sounds good. Yay. Thanks for having us.
Have a good night, and we will be chatting soon.
All right, have a good one.
Okay. Bye. Okay, you guys take care. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you again to Diane and Arlen for joining us this week for our read-along. Please join us back next week where we will be discussing Chapter 6 of the Dragonfly and Amber read-along, entitled Making Waves. Thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to our next episode. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/OutlanderPod or email us at OutlanderPod@gmail.com.
I dreamt it last night that my young